Well, let's start with this. Welcome back to New England. How is the house coming, Ms. Blandings?
It's about, I feel like I've said this for a very long time, but it's about seven, we're 75% done. And I work around the schedule of my dear carpenter, Jack of all trades. His name is actually Jack. So I work around him, and he's very popular in these parts. So we have one section left, which is my upstairs bedroom and my bathroom. So that's the lot. And then outside we have a whole kind of area, but it's a big farm. There's a barn and there's a lot of acreage. So most of the house is done. And most of the worst part of the house is done, but then I'm also working on the outside and the barn, but all the horror stuff is pretty much behind me. I think, I hope.
How's your dog do when there's work and construction going on?
Well, he's, you know, it's funny. He's very selective on who he likes and who he doesn't like. If the person's there for a long time, he's very used to them. So he likes the electrician and he likes Jack, my carpenter, but people who come in and out, he's not as friendly to them. He likes the plumber. He likes one of the plumbers, but he's selective. He's asleep right over there.
Oh, so good. That's like most of my listeners. That's fantastic. Yeah. Well, how did the idea for this wonderful book about Connecticut in the movies first come to you?
Well, it always, you know, it's funny. It's one of those things that it always percolated in my brain, being from Connecticut, that this stereotype of when you would say, oh, where are you from? I'm from Connecticut. Oh, Connecticut. And I thought, you know, no one says, oh, Ohio, or oh, Pennsylvania. You know, there's just certain assumptions about Connecticut. So that always percolated in my head. Then cut to me meeting Frank Perry when I worked for Peggy Siegel, and we shared offices with him, and that's, I got my start in the movies, doing a little bit part in a film, and he gave me a copy of his movie, The Swimmer, and the whole thing was set in Connecticut, and it's so strange and weird, and that set me on, you know, writing, reading John Cheever, and again, percolating, wow, that's interesting, again, this other segment of Connecticut, and then cut to many years later when I'm working on Trailers from Hell, and I did an essay on The Swimmer, and it was very well received and picked up by a lot of, you know, different sites and everything. And that's when I began to think, well, maybe there's a movie maybe there's a book in here. And the way I approach any book is similar to the way I would act in a movie. I don't want to just do an IMDb list of like movies in Connecticut. I wanted there to be a through line of why I was writing the book. And then that's when I came up with the idea of, well, how do we get, since I wrote The Swimmer first as an experiment, I thought, how do we get to The Swimmer? And then that's when I decided to go back in time. What surprised me was I didn't know that silent films were made here. So that was a big surprise. But I wanted to tell the story of the changing perception of Connecticut, mainly created by Hollywood, that started in the 1930s with these romantic comedies like Bringing Up Baby and Theodora Goes Wild, and how we went from idyllic Christmas in Connecticut to dark suburbia, suburban angst, The Ice Storm is a contemporary film. And now when a film is set in Connecticut, it usually signals to the audience something terrible is going to happen. And I wanted to tell that story. So that was my premise. And as I got into that the book broadened into really a road trip movie book, coffee table book, because I was learning about history and true crime and horror films, and it became really, really fun for me to try to include all of these movies to show a broad depiction of the state.
Well, I love some of the early history and things I was not aware of, like the story of William Gillette, the original Sherlock Holmes.
Yes, it's completely unknown history, and I don't know if Connecticut has low self-esteem that they don't, it's always, Connecticut is like the state in between, Massachusetts and New York. And so it's like between Boston and New York City. And yet some of the greatest writers have worked here. Scott Fitzgerald wrote The Great Gatsby here, and Noel Coward wrote plays here and traveled to Broadway. Lillian Hellman, Ilya Kazan, William Styron, on and on, Arthur Miller. And yet that's never been gathered in one opus. And so the book is an attempt to create a brand for Connecticut, that this is who we are, and this is what we stand for.
I like the chapter on what you call the country living comedies, and you mentioned Theodora Goes Wild with your grandfather, Melvin Douglas, who is so brilliant in it, and one of my favorite actors of all time, the wonderful Irene Dunne. I love that movie.
Yes, for Irene Dunne, this was really a risky thing for her because she really didn't want to do a comedy, and she was so good in the film, and the director of it was Richard Boleslavsky. And there was an interesting tie-in with that to Connecticut, which, again, I was completely unaware of. He was an incredible director. He died very young, so not very many people know about him. But he came from the Stanislavs Theater in Russia. Stanislavsky Method was the introduction, which what we now know is the Actor's Studio type of acting, a more realistic approach to acting. And in the 1930s in Brookfield, Connecticut, he was part of the group theater along with Sanford Meisner and Lee Strasberg, Stella Adler, and, all these, Harold Klerman, many, many other people that were, John Garfield, that were in Connecticut experimenting on plays. And they put on, they rehearsed Waiting for Lefty. So this was the start of the change in American theater. It all began in Brookfield, Connecticut, and that director was a part of that, and he carried that realistic approach to acting into Theodora Goes Wild, which sets it apart from other screwball comedies. I think there's a naturalism in the film that I really appreciate.
I was surprised to learn that Bringing Up Baby did not especially impress the studio. They didn't like Katharine Hepburn's look. They weren't crazy about her performance.
No, another. And again, that's an example of a movie. This is our brand is created in a sense right there. Katharine Hepburn Bringing Up Baby. That is a snapshot of what we think of when we think of Connecticut, a kooky heiress, wealthy, has the tight jaw way of talking, and wealthy kooky relatives, and that is who she was, and that's who her family is, that's what they celebrate at the Kate Museum, and she really is an example of a modern actress, but she was a little bit ahead of her time in that film, and because the film didn't do well, she goes back to Broadway and her roots in Connecticut, does this play, Philadelphia Story, and comes back and is, conquers Hollywood, becomes a big star.
Christmas in Connecticut, you write about that. It's in many ways the quintessential Connecticut and quintessential holiday movie. And yet there's also a story ahead of its time of an independent working woman. And it's a fascinating duality there. Plus, it includes one of my all time favorite character actors, Cuddles Sackle. If he's in it, I'm in.
I know. There's so much food in the movie. They're always talking about food and making food. I thought it would be a great idea that you could make the movie, as I suggest in the book. You can make the movie and then have a menu around the movie and make everything that they make in the film. What's interesting about that film in the trajectory of Connecticut films is that The movie takes place in the 1940s. She is a career, cynical career gal who doesn't want to get married. She has a boyfriend who's kind of a, he's snooty, you know, they don't meld at all. But interestingly, he is making prefab houses. Mm. So this is a interesting post-war little note there. But she goes to his country house in Connecticut with this ruse. And then we have this transformation where she falls in love with, you know, country living and, you know, falls in love with this soldier. But the end of the movie is she gets to keep her, which is very unusual. She gets to keep her job at the magazine. She maintains a good relationship with her ex, with her boss, and she gets the guy. So what shifted after that from Mr. Blandings on is that women are come to Connecticut, really their husbands take them out of the city and now they're trapped in suburbia. And then we get all these kind of dark films. And then in the next group is the 60s sex comedies. But that's why Christmas in Connecticut is so ahead of his time. I don't think anybody realizes that at the end of the movie, she gets to keep her job and she gets the guy.
We're talking with Ileana Douglas about her wonderful new book, Connecticut in the Movies. Well, let's talk about Mr. Blandings builds his dream house. I love the film. Your grandfather is great in it. There's some suspicion there on the part of Cary Grant. What has gone on with this dear friend when he returns to the house? But it's the classic film about the dream of suburbia, as you entitled the chapter, and then the reality of it.
Yeah, this Mr. Blandings, in terms of my research of Connecticut, no other film created the image of perfect living in Connecticut, a superior way of living, you know, a way of life, a better class of people. And that's not necessarily right or wrong, but in the post-war, it was, you have to get out of the city in order to live a better life for your kids. You're going to have more room, you know, it won't be as cramped. But to me, the whole movie is centered around in the beginning, and Cary Grant is an ad man, is he looks at a magazine and there's a, you know, an advertisement for Connecticut, and it says, you know, a better way to live. And that's, and I think it's so funny because it's a movie, it's not real life. And yet the film sold this idea of superior living in Connecticut. And when the movie came out, you know, accompanied it with, you could buy a kid house and you could live in the exact house that the Blandings lived in. And it worked. And there's Blanding houses all over America. There's four in Connecticut. I took a photograph of two of them. But I think that in no other movie created that dream of suburbia. But once they got here, you know, it doesn't, the end of the movie is that they're all there and they're incredibly happy. But the next group of movies are Gentleman's Agreement, Man in the Gray Flannel Suit. Now that they're in suburbia and away from New York, this is where the cracks in the American family appear. And I found that to be an interesting journey.
Well, and those suburban sex comedies, I'm thinking especially of Wives and Lovers, they haven't aged very well.
Oh my God. Well, the first thing I noticed in them, because no one's ever studied sex comedies as a serious genre of film, but yet there's so many of them that I think they really do need to be studied, because what are we saying about the culture, and what was Hollywood saying about the culture, and were these things really going on? I mean, in some instances, you have actors like Richard Widmark that really were living in right. Connecticut, and then also appearing, you know, in these movies. So there's kind of a nudge, nudge, wink, wink about all of these sex comedies. But the first thing I noticed was the children immediately disappear. Whereas in Mr. Blandings, remember, the children are very much a part of the movie.
Right.
and their opinions matter, and they're, you know, they're making fun of their dad, and they're, you know, that he's a shallow advertisement guy. By the time we get to, you know, movies like Wives and Lovers, the children are gone, or they're told, there's a very specific scene where one of the kids is told not to bother her father because he's working hard and making them money. And, you know, they're, it shows, even though they're supposed to be funny, it shows the divide that the men were now commuting to New York, often having their own apartments, and the wives were left in Connecticut. And, you know, in Wives and Lovers, there's a whole lecture that Shelley Winters gives Janet Leigh about, well, you're going to have to learn how to decorate your house and give cocktail parties and make sure that you know that everybody drinks vodka. There, I've never seen more drinking in a movie.
I want to talk about a film that I have not seen, and I feel pretty good. I've seen most of the films in the book. How did I miss Boomerang? And I need to rectify that immediately.
Yeah, that's Boomerang is one of my favorite films that I wrote about. And again, based on a true story that happened in Connecticut, a murder in 1924, unsolved to this day. You know, again, part of the reason of doing the book is, you know, you never know. Maybe they can solve the murder, because I'm sort of fascinated.
Right. Was it in Bridgeport?
It was in Bridgeport. Someone came up behind. There was a very beloved priest. A man came up behind him, shot him in the head. They never found the culprit. But the pressure to solve the crime of this beloved priest meant that they pinned it on a soldier who they'd found. He was kind of drunk and disorderly, and the police just decided to pin this crime on him. And and Homer Cumming, who was the prosecutor in Fairfield County, he came in and he went after speaking to the soldier, whose name was Harold Israel, came to the conclusion that it was a coerced confession. But he didn't tell anybody. He was very, I mean, this was a Perry Mason moment. He goes to court and he says it's just as important to defend the innocent as it is to convict the guilty, and announces in a packed courtroom that he's switching sides and he's going to defend. I mean, it was I can't even imagine how dramatic this is. And so Harold Israel gets off. There's a whole backstory, which I discovered, where they become friends. He negotiates the rights for Harold Israel for them to make the movie. They stay in touch. It's a beautiful relationship. And Homer Cumming is then later tapped to be Attorney General under FDR. So it is a fantastic Connecticut story, and one to really be proud of.
I have to see that soon. I love one of the sidebar stories about the film that happened in Jane, to Jane, which is set here in Maine, Cape Ann, Maine, but the story of Max Showalter, who ended up moving to Chester, Connecticut.
Yes, and he appears in two Connecticut films, It Happened to Jane and then My Six Loves, which is another one of the 60s sex comedy.
With friend of our show Barry Livingston as a young actor.
Yes, and that was a really kooky movie. It's got a lot of good people in it. Cliff Robertson is in it, and but Max Showalter in that plays a derelict uncle of six kids who he leaves at someone. It's completely crazy, the plot, but anyway, he shows up in My Six Loves. But in It Happened to Jane, he went and he shot the film in Chester along with Jack Lemmon, Ernie Kovacs, Doris Day. They were all living in Chester, and Doris Day was living in Deep River, which was nearby. And he fell in love with Chester and lived there, and people knew him. He left a lot of his artifacts at the Goodspeed Opera House so in East Haddam. So he was a major. I mean, I'm so sorry. I wish I'd kind of, by the time I wrote the book, he had died, and I think also his partner had died, but a great Connecticut story.
When you talk about Connecticut cameos of wonderful films like Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court, It's a Wonderful Life. And I was so happy to see you write about what I think is an unjustly overlooked film, Away We Go, with Maya Rudolph and John Krasinski.
Yes, it was, you know, when you're writing a book like this and you have, I mean, all in all, okay, there's, you know, close to 300 films were made in Connecticut or about Connecticut. So how do you go about picking the films? And as I said, it's not an IMDb list yet. I wanted to find a clever way to include certain films that where I thought there was a funny twist. And Away We Go, which is a really, you know, interesting, wonderful film, is shot entirely in Connecticut, but never identified as Connecticut. So I had to pick out a photograph of, okay, I know that's New Haven. So, you know, let me use this still of New Haven, but, or All About Eve, which also figures in New Haven, but you never, you know, there, it takes place at the Taft Hotel, and they use rear screen projection of the Schubert, but they were never, they have footage of the theater, and then it cuts, which is so strange. I don't know why they did that. It cuts to a rear projection shot. Maybe it was a reshoot of Ann Baxter and George Sanders and you can see them walking and the Schubert is behind them. So it was a clever way to include Connecticut.
I think maybe my favorite part of the book was in the chapter on creepy Connecticut. I love the story of filmmaker Del Tenney.
Completely unknown to me before I started in the book. One of my favorite things, again, is just to shine a light on any filmmaker who is there slogging away. Nobody really knows about him. Maybe he has a small cult following. And to really highlight that Del Tenney was former actor. He was in Stalag 17 on Broadway and started, you know, writing and directing horror films with his wife and in Stamford, Connecticut. And they made these low budget horror movies for the drive-ins. And they were incredibly successful. And one of them, of course, which later got picked up, I think, by Shout, you know, the horror, can't even say it with a straight face, the horror of Party Beach, I think it's called. But what I found incredibly fascinating was, it's so hard, you know, you go down a rabbit hole with these things, is that Tenney's wife, they were living in the same studio where the sculptor who had sculpted Mount Rushmore.
Right.
And that in the same studio where he had carved Mount Rushmore, they're making, you know, rubber suits for zombies that, I think, what's the story? They get polluted.
Some sort of industrial contamination that leads to these mutations.
Exactly. And I don't know, they're wearing these crazy rubber shoots, but it has, I call it the kitchen sink for, it's like a biker movie. It's got some music in it. And some of the stories that he tells are really, fantastic. Now that would have been enough. But as I continued to read about Del Tenney and his wife, they took all of their money and they started the Hartman Theater.
Right.
You know, again, unfortunately, is now no longer in existence. But that, to me, is, again, why I wrote the book, is that here are these two residents and artists. She performed many times. I have a photograph of her performing at the Hartman Theater. So these are really, you know, Connecticut natives that we should really be taking a little bit more notice of and embracing and saying, you know, this is part of our brand.
You also write about a film you know very well, the first LGBTQ film in Connecticut, the wonderful The Green.
The Green, again, this was part of my research. I was talking to Paul Marcuselli, who's the producer of the film, and I was doing my research, and I said, Paul, I think I can write truthfully that we are the very first, you know, gay film made in Connecticut. I couldn't find anything previous, you know, to that. So that's something I'm very proud of. We shot the whole film in Guilford. Guilford, Connecticut is just an incredible community, and they opened their arms to us, and making the film was really special. And my mom drove me to the set every day. So you can't beat that.
If you look at films, Ileana, like The Ice Storm, Revolutionary Road, and you talked about this earlier, setting a film these days in Connecticut is very different than the days of, the idyllic country lifestyle. What does it say today when producers make that choice?
Well, this is why I wanted to separate films from what I call dark suburbia, which begins in the 50s. It's like, okay, we're not in Blanding's world anymore. This is dark suburbia. And then we get into the 70s, but then we get into a full, you know, decade later where we're in the 90s and the 2000s. And we have a lot of these films. It begins with Ice Storm, Revolutionary Road, Far From Heaven, Todd Haynes' film, where they are contemporary films about the past. Mm-hmm. But they give characters from the past a modern voice, so in which they are commenting on the past. So therefore, I had to differentiate it from dark suburbia to dark suburbia redux. But in all of these films, what I noticed was there is a somewhat artistic, almost stately vibe. You know, everyone wearing vintage clothing, but in total despair about their life. And they're interesting, but that they comment that it's complete despair now and darkness. Living in suburbia is prison.
Well, it is an absolutely wonderful read. As someone born in Hartford, though, I only spent a few months there. It felt like going home in a strange way for me. And for anybody who is a film fan, it's so great to read again about these movies and the stories behind them. As always, as you did in your first book, I Blame Peter Fonda, your love of film, your knowledge of film comes through. And it's a great travelogue of these wonderful movies made in your state.
Now, I have to say, I blame Dennis Hopper.
Oh, Dennis Hopper. I said Peter Fonda, didn't I?
They go hand-in-hand.
Yes, they do. Yes. I want to mention, too, before we let you go, that you're going to be doing a live appearance at the Kate in Old Saybrook coming up on November 15th.
Yes, I'm very excited. The Kate Theater, there's a Katharine Hepburn Museum there. Hepburn, of course, the ambassador of Connecticut, figures highly in the film, and with the ticket price, it includes a free book. So, you know, and I'll be signing it. So you can't beat that. I'm going to be interviewed by Colin McEnroe, and we're going to be doing some giveaways, and it'll be a lot of fun. So November 15th, 7 p.m. Get your tickets now.
Well, the book is great. It's going to be one of those books I keep right on the shelf so I can refer to it anytime a film comes on, set in Connecticut, filmed in Connecticut. It's a great resource and a wonderfully fun read. Always great to talk with you, Ileana. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Rich. Thanks so much.
Best of luck with the house, and I hope the dog likes most of the visitors that come in to do work.
He's still asleep, so he's not impressed at all.
Well, he can take a number. Thanks so much, Ileana.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye now.